Okay, we're going to have Rob and Brett on this afternoon, just giving a summary and trying to put together all the things that went on, which is probably going to be pretty difficult. And if we have a chance, we'll bring over the one of the Russian scientists with his interpreter in a little while. Okay, Rob.
As I said, I'm going to talk about a session which was mainly for the mineral freaks. There was an awful lot of very interesting information there, which fascinates me, but I know very well you would not find interesting and you would not get stories from. So let me, instead of trying to summarize the whole session, I'll concentrate on the more flamboyant and interesting things that came out. To me, the most interesting, at least as far as you people are concerned, and I think generally scientifically interesting thing this afternoon, was a paper by a group from Heidelberg, Elgoraci Ramdor, and I've forgotten the other authors. That's Elgoresy or Sey, I've forgotten. You can look it up in the catalog, in which he discussed the famous rusty rock from Apollo 16, 66095. He described the silicate mineralogy, which is like many other Apollo 16 rocks. But the important thing about that rock, the thing that makes it different to the others, is that it does contain rust, and the abundance of rust is greater than has been seen in any other lunar rock. And what he did, his thing, is to take an instrument called an electron microprobe, which can give you major element and minor element chemical analyses on a 1 micron spot, so you can move over a 10 micron area and get many analyses and measure the composition of tiny mineral grains. And what he found in there was, first of all, the mineral sphalerite, which is zinc sulfide, sphalerite, S-P-H-A-L-E-R-I-T-E. It's a zinc sulfide. It's the major mineral for zinc ores on Earth. This has never been before reported in a lunar sample. Well, you might say, ho-hum, so what? But let me go on. He also found a mineral called coenite, which occurs in meteorites. It is C-O-H-E-N-I-T-E, and it's an iron nickel carbide. This establishes that the metal from this particular rock, and it's fairly metal rich, is to some extent of meteoritic origin, and we're not dealing with indigenous lunar metal. He also found, and I've been leaving the best till last, he also found goethite, which of course was reported before. That's G-O-E-T-H-I-T-E, named after Goethe. It's a hydrated iron oxide, common rust on Earth. It's the main mineral which we call rust. There are a number of different other minerals which make up rust. And associated with this goethite, he found zinc iron sulfates with some chlorine. Now, sulfates have never before been seen in lunar samples. He also found the zinc-iron-chlorine compound. These are very small grains, and the exact chemistry, apparently, the grain was too small to determine the chemistry more than semi-quantitatively. He also found phosphates of some of these elements, iron and so on, associated with this business. He also found a lead-rich mineral. Again, too small to positively identify, but the lead was as high as 4,000 parts per million, 0.4 weight percent lead, which is orders of magnitude higher than the lead content found in any previous lunar mineral. All right, well, those of you who know which elements are volatile and which aren't, you can see that what we're dealing with is a whole concentration of volatile elements around this hydrous iron oxide, around this goethite, the volatile elements being zinc, chlorine, the presence of sulfate, suggesting also suggestive somewhat of volatilization, the presence of lead, which is a volatile element. So we're not only dealing with alteration due to H2O, but there are also other volatile elements associated with this rust, which had not been previously established. Now, the big question is, how did the rust form? This also certainly indicates that the rust is of lunar origin, plus the fact that recently some samples from Apollo 16, some coarse fines, have been unpacked, and they've been in vacuum, And these two, some of them were found to contain the same goethite, which was seen in some of the other samples which had been exposed to air on the way back. These were still had the lunar vacuum. There was no question that the oxidation could have occurred at some later stage, so that we know now that we are dealing positively with a lunar phenomenon and not a late-stage alteration, added to the fact the zinc, the chlorine, the sulfate, the lead, not the sort of thing that you just get by a lunar rock rusting while it was sitting in the LRL or coming back on the Carrier or something like that. All right, the big question, how did this form? And the answer is nobody knows. The theories that have been advanced, El Gorasi is pushing the comet hypothesis, comets consisting largely of frozen water, that is ice, with a large abundance of volatile elements associated. By volatile elements, the same zinc, cadmium, chlorine, and other volatile elements. And so that's one possibility. You add this to the paper by Everett Gibson here from MSC, recently in Science, in which he postulated on the basis of gas analyses of soils that from 16, the North Ray crater may have been formed by a comet. At least we have two different pieces of evidence, and two investigators suggest comet. El Gorasi also suggested as another possibility, instead of a comet, carbonaceous chondrite impact. Carbonaceous chondrites are the most primitive meteorites there are, and they're the meteorites which are most rich in volatile elements. They contain considerable water, and they do contain high abundances of some of the elements that I've mentioned. So that's a second possibility. A third possibility, which was not mentioned this afternoon, but was discussed by Ed Anders this morning in his paper in Building 1, based on different evidence, analysis of volatile elements in some of the Apollo 16 soils, and has suggested that we may be dealing with real lunar fumaroles. I personally don't prefer that possibility. I prefer more the extralunar bombardment by comet or carbonaceous chondrite or something like that. And so that's pretty much the story of, we have established that the rust is lunar, and we do find all sorts of fancy volatile elements. There is not, at the moment, a concrete positive explanation of how this was formed. The second thing of interest this afternoon, and I'm not ranking things in order of importance, was the Russian paper, and I hope that we'll hear from them themselves later on during this meeting. A third thing, one of the investigators pointed out that the reduction which you get during late-stage cooling of lunar rocks can also be formed by shock. He'd done some experiments in the lab and reproduced some of the reduction reactions which we see in the lunar rocks, and he was pointing out that this can be a shock effect just as much as being a slow cooling effect, at least in some rocks. Another investigator discussed the possible occurrence of silicon carbide on the moon. He's not sure because the silicon carbide has always been found as isolated grains, never absolutely wrapped up in a lunar fragment. This was in soil, and if so, this would be interesting because silicon carbide does not occur as a mineral on Earth. It does occur very rarely in meteorites. On the other hand, it's a common polishing compound used in preparing rocks, silicon compound, carbide. It's a good abrasive, and he himself says that he hasn't discounted the possibility that this silicon carbide could be contamination. There were two papers which discussed the opaque minerals in the Apollo 17 samples, but I think that most of this will be gone over again on Thursday, and unless you've got particular questions about that, I think probably best to wait till Thursday. But mainly pointing out the much better development of subsolidus reduction in the Apollo 17 samples, as evidenced by spectacular development of rutile, that's titanium oxide, and spinel from the ilmenites, suggesting possibly different cooling histories from the Apollo 11 rocks, which are rather similar in chemistry, as I know you've heard. A group of which I was a member gave a paper and pointed out that the Apollo 16 rocks can be classified into three distinct groups on the basis of their texture, and this texture certainly tells you something either about the chemistry of the rock or the thermal history of the rock. And what we showed was that one particular type had cooled much more slowly than some of the, had cooled more slowly than some of the other types. And for most of them, though, we're talking about cooling rates of the order of, a couple of months at most. Now, I think the important thing in this, if we are talking about these breccias cooling within a couple of months, a few months, that a large sort of worlds in collision ejecta blanket, you know, thousands of feet or even 1,000 meters, which you might expect to get from some large collision if you're close in, something like Imbrium or Serenitatis, I personally would expect longer cooling rates than a couple of months. So therefore, we're postulating, or I'm postulating here, that the 16 samples that we've looked at were either derived from very near the top of a large ejecta blanket, or more likely from one or a series of smaller impacts, smaller than Imbrium and so on. Otherwise, you would have got much longer cooling times. Then the final thing for the real mineral freaks, you just missed out on a beautiful house of wax, 3D pictures of superb iron crystals in some of the 16 samples. This iron is formed by volatile action at high temperatures during the cooling at temperatures like 1,000 degrees or so. For those of you who are writing, I don't think there's anything there, but for those of you who like to or can publish pictures, some of these things are absolutely spectacular. Go and see Yul Clanton or Dave McKay, both of whom are from MSC.
If you have questions, I'd ask that you wait for the microphone, please.
Before the Russian, or even if he does come or doesn't come, could you tell us what you thought was important about what he said?
I think what he was trying to do was to summarize really all their mineralogical findings. Now, we've been working on the Luna 20 samples, and there's a stack of papers this thick in my office of various groups' mineralogical work on the Luna 20 sample. And what he was trying to do was to discuss the general chemistry of every mineral and point out very broadly what would characterize the sample. It was really a PET report, if you like, because he was trying to cover the whole waterfront. And what he particularly talked about were the titanium-aluminum ratios and pyroxenes. He talked about the compositional variations in spinels. He talked about the plagioclases, iron contents, and so on. He also pointed out that they found a mineral which is an aluminum carbide, apparently, which I've never, it doesn't occur either on Earth or in meteorites as a mineral, aluminum carbide. He says more work has to be done to characterize this phase, but if this is, in fact, a lunar mineral, it's a very interesting one.
I didn't understand all that 1 to 4 and 1 to 2 that they got all excited about. Could you put that in simple?
It's pyroxenes are, you know, one of the most abundant minerals in lunar samples. And you can tell a lot about the crystallization of a pyroxene when it came out during the crystallization sequence from a melt. You can tell something, in fact, quite a lot about the chemistry of the melt. In a case where you have very fine-grained fragments, as you do in the Luna 20 samples, where you don't get great big fat rocks, which you can knock a chunk off and get an analysis which you know will be representative of a whole rock type. To play games like this with the pyroxenes is very important because you can learn an enormous amount about the particular chemistry of the rocks. And what he was talking about were there are north acidic types. He was talking about troctolites, which are fundamentally olivine plagioclase rocks, commonly in the Luna 20 with spinel, which is magnesium aluminum oxide, and just getting into these details which delight people like me but make most of you yawn very much.
About the rusty rock, could you describe the size and appearance of the rock, and was the rock picked up near North Ray Crater?
Rusty rock came from Station 6. No, I can't remember exactly. I can find out for you, but I've forgotten exactly where it did come from, John.
Wasn't the Gibson's findings related to North Ray Crater, didn't it?
He was working on soil that was, he believes on the basis of its chemistry, was derived from North Ray Crater rather than from South Ray. And rusty rock was from the general vicinity of his soil, but I don't exactly know, you know, how far away. As far as size, as I remember it, don't forget it's very difficult to go to one of these sessions and not know that you're being asked to summarize it, and you don't have details of the shape of rusty rock in your head. But as I remember it, it's a long, somewhat axe-like thing. In other words, long, rectangular thing, but, you know, some sharp angles. I can't remember the weight. The rust you can see with the naked eye, even in the LRL mugshot, you can see these brown specks, which are quite abundant. Let's say you could probably count 20 specks on each surface of the rock that you're looking at, and these are of the order of half a millimeter or so maximum, and then you get the thing under the microscope, and you can see many smaller ones, and then you look at a thin section of the rock. Of course, you can get much higher magnification, and you not only see the rust spots themselves, but you see diffuse red stains going out from there as well.
Does the rust, is that just on the surface, or does it extend?
It permeates the whole rock. When the rock was cut, the same alteration was seen throughout the rock. There didn't appear to be any difference at all. There was some suggestion that it was more pronounced around fractures, and what this suggests is El Gerasi pointed out, he didn't like to say what the origin of it was, but definitely he was talking about hydrothermal activity, hydrothermal meaning steam, in which a number of other volatile elements are dissolved, if you like, in this vapor phase, and of hydrothermal fluids, gases, permeating the rock. He also pointed out that he thought that the alteration, he ruled out the fumarolic idea because the width of the alteration zone was extremely small. We're talking about, in some cases, a couple of microns. If a rock's caught up in a fumarole, it's going to be caught up for quite a while, and surely the alteration is going to be greater than this very, very small amount. And so, therefore, for this reason, he was talking of a much more cataclysmic thing, something that took of the order of a few seconds to maximum an hour or so. And so for this reason, he prefers the comet and carbonaceous chondrite idea. This is my own rather than his, another reason why I would prefer this to the fumarolic idea, fumaroles are characteristically found in volcanic areas, and 66095 is not an original indigenous crystalline lunar rock, it's a breccia. Yes. Yes.
How do you have any idea about how fast it might have taken this rust to have formed? And are you satisfied of the sequence? That is, first you have a rock without rust, and then you have the rust forming by whatever process over however long a time. I mean, there are some questions in there which I wonder if you can answer now or if you will ever be able to answer.
Okay, well, I think we must say that the rusting was the last mineralogical change that happened to that rock. The rust wasn't formed at the same time that the rock, which, being a breccia, but a very well crystallized breccia, probably been exposed to temperatures at least around 1,100 degrees in its reheating, was presumably a rock, crystalline rock from the original crust, which was then, or bits of a number of rocks, which were bashed up, then formed in an ejecta blanket, metamorphosed to temperatures, let's say, of around 1,100 degrees, cooled down, and then later on, this hydrothermal activity took place. One of the reasons why I can say later on is that the mineral goethite is not stable at 1,100 degrees. It's only stable at relatively low temperatures, and so therefore this had to be a late-stage business. Secondly, you see the rust permeating along fractures, and we know that the fractures weren't there when the rock was first formed. The fracturing occurred later, and since the rusting is later than the fractures, again, we can say it's the last thing that happened to the rock. Well, as El Gerasi pointed out this afternoon, on the basis of the very thin rims of goethite, of the sphalerite, and so on, he's thinking more in terms of maximum hours, possibly even minutes, rather than years, tens of years, and so on, which you're so used to hearing about those sort of times around here.
Would goethite be stable in the highly reducing atmosphere of the moon even after it cooled down?
This troubled some people, but a fellow called Dick Williams and Everett Gibson here at MSC have either got a paper in press or it's been published in Earth and Planetary Science Letters pointing out that under certain conditions in the lunar environment, namely low temperatures, a fair partial pressure of H2O, relative lack of carbon, a number of other constraints, you can in fact have goethite stable in the lunar environment.
Another question. When you see spectra in a comet, what do you see? Separate zinc and separate sulfur? And if that's the case, how did they get combined into sphalerite on the moon?
Spectra in a comet, this is getting beyond my area, but spectra in a comet, you're looking at the tail, which is the comet burning up. In that case, you're dealing with vapors. It's the same business as using a optical emission spectrograph in a way in which you actually burn the thing to give out light, and so you can find out what elements are present. In the comet itself, these elements could be combined. We have no idea what the minerals might be. My first guess would be the same minerals that you get in carbonaceous chondrite.
What I'm asking, do you see these spectra in comet tails? Do you see zinc?
You see zinc. You see all these elements that I mentioned.
Would you please wait for the microphone?
Excuse me. One more question. Where did the carbon come from to combine with the aluminum in this carbide mineral?
Well, the carbide mineral, he only just mentioned it very briefly. He just said that we've found this new mineral, this new phase, an aluminum carbide, and there may be other elements in there as well. And he said that they're still doing work on it, so I know no more than that.
Okay, but can you elaborate a little bit on it? Has aluminum carbide been made on Earth? You say it doesn't occur naturally. And why would it be interesting beyond the fact that it's unusual?
Aluminum, well, to answer the first part of your question, it doesn't occur on Earth. It doesn't occur in meteorites. Whether or not it's used in industry, I have no idea. It's certainly been synthesized by somebody, if only to work out the chemistry of the aluminum-carbon system, but I have no idea if it's commercially used at all. Why would it be interesting? Aluminum characteristically, combines with oxygen, and so all the aluminum in lunar samples is combined Al2O3, aluminum oxide, either in the silicates like plagioclase, like pyroxene, like the spinels, the oxide minerals, but it's never seen combined as a sulfide or a carbide or a phosphide or anything that's more reduced. What we're talking about having an aluminum carbide is we're saying that this mineral must have formed under an extremely reducing environment. Otherwise, it would have formed, the aluminum would have gone to aluminum oxide.
I'm kind of curious about something, if you can answer it. How much American work has been done on Luna 20 versus what the Russians have done with the Luna 20? In other words, how would the stack in your office compare with the stack in Moscow? The paper race, I guess you could call
it. Okay,
well,
I can't answer that question because the stack in my office is kept there as a stack because it's preprints of people's papers that have not yet appeared in print. And presumably, some guy in Russia has also got a stack of papers that have also not appeared in print. I haven't seen anything published yet on the Russian Luna 20 sample, so therefore I can't comment about on the amount of work that they versus the U.S. investigators.
Are there any questions?
Yes. I wanted to get straight on the...
Anything I told you would be hearsay and on the basis of no knowledge.
On this rusty rock, the idea is that, excuse me, the rock existed, and sometime afterwards it was sprinkled with some free water or some way.
I think steam more than steam. Water, right. Jerry.
And the water could have come either from a comet or a carbonaceous crondite, is that?
Well, no, what I said was the theories that are being presented are a comet or a carbonaceous chondrite, and then a third possibility, which I don't favor as much, a fumarole. And then, since I said these are the three theories presented, alternatively, there may be some other process which I haven't mentioned, which I don't know about at all.
Question, and I don't want to jump the gun on Thursday afternoon, but the orange soil, is that rust or...
No, this was discussed again this afternoon. There was a part of one of the guy's papers, Larry Taylor's paper, was on the orange soil, and a question was raised afterwards whether there was any ferric iron, and to have rust around the place, you've got to have ferric iron, and indicating a high degree of oxidation. And one of the people in the audience, Peter Bell, said that on the basis of Mosbau work and other work, he can say that the ferric iron content doesn't appear to be any different to other lunar samples.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Well, I'm sorry to say that the Russian was not found by his interpreter. I was informed a little while ago. We'll try and bring him in later.